Good afternoon. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 24th, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Ben Stewart, our village pastor. Today's session number is STB 2001-01, and it's titled, How Do We Do Jubilee Today? Let's listen in to Ben and his class.
Y'all, I'm Ben. I'm the village pastor, just to kind of make sure you're in the right place. The idea today is kind of anticipating this Jubilee celebration that we're going to have Thursday, is how to take some of the themes and maybe the things that we do here and make them work at home, and how can the liturgies of our church and our churches themselves encourage the kind of justice and mercy that's promoted in Jubilee. How can that be an ongoing process in our churches? And then maybe to ask who out there in the world might be an ally of the church in doing this kind of countercultural Jubilee bit. I'm saying this recognizing we may not know much about Jubilee yet, but that's part of what this is about. That's where you want to be. Okay. Good. Well, maybe beginning there then. Just as a beginning point, when you hear the word jubilee in a biblical context, what are the things that come to mind, if any?
Well, all I know, and I can't even remember, it's the forgiveness of debt or forgiveness of debt, I guess, is what I think, more of that than sin. It's the more person-to-person.
Definitely, yeah, forgiveness of debts.
Is every 10 years or 20 or 100 or 500 or I don't know. Okay, there was a time frame, so it wasn't like every week or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And only so much of something like
that.
Yeah,
so that's
all. Yeah, okay, good. Forgiveness of debts. Forgiveness of sin a little bit in there too, yeah. Other stuff for the moment?
I got the answer in front of me. I guess we have.
Are you a little bit? No fair. What comes to mind before you crack open the Bible?
Context, the word jubilee kind of makes you think of joyous celebration, and so it's celebrating in the forgiveness of debts, is celebrating in the equality of people. It's not simply about going through the steps, but it's celebrating while you do it.
Wow, okay, so there's some celebration involved. It's not just politically correct to do this. Yes, Michael.
Just two of the ways it's made it into our culture, that, you know, Jubilee is like every 50 years, and so when people celebrate their 50th wedding anniversary, that's their Jubilee anniversary, or businesses in for 50 years, they have a Jubilee anniversary. Or at least with the turn of the millennium here, there was the year of Jubilee where a lot of countries got to, I know it happened in Canada, for example, where we were talking about forgiving third world countries their debt, or at least lowering the amount of money they owed, and that was a Jubilee year, and in many senses that was a very successful project. Yeah. That happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that largely came out of church groups.
Right.
And
it was a worldwide church group movement to have a year of jubilee to forgive third world debt.
Mm-hmm. Anything else to remind the people? You'll get the answer shortly. I want to read a little bit from Gail Ramshaw's definition. This is in her book, Letters for God's Name, under the letter J. Gail's a expert on liturgical language, and her daughter works in the kitchen here.
Mary. Somebody got my seat.
Sorry, did I take your seat?
Well, you've got to save it.
You want to read all about this in like all the detail, more detail than you'd like to, you can look in Leviticus 25, and it just spells this out in painstaking detail. But a lot of those books do that. So, but here's a concise summary. Leviticus says that on Mount Sinai, the Lord instructed Moses in the way of Jubilee. First, you guys know about Sabbath. Every 7 days there's a rest, right? every 70 years, the land would have a sabbatical, Shabbat, like a Sabbath. No crops planted, not even straggling shoots would be harvested. It was a year to rest in the Lord. A lot of environmentalists notice this these days. We let the land just do nothing. God wants us to do that sometimes. But once every 50 years would come the Jubilee of Jubilees. It's 7 times 7. So it's a Sabbath of Sabbaths plus one. And in that year, the land lying fallow would be the least of the signs of the time of the Lord. The trumpet would blow. We'll do that on Thursday. And the reason we do it here is because it's the 50th day of summer season. And families would reassemble. They'd come back to their homelands. Land sold to pay off loans would be given back. Houses that the rich had acquired from the poor would be returned. People indentured slavery to settle great debts would be released. It was a free redemption. All the way around, debts were paid off because they were completely forgiven. So you can, and it's kind of every generation, things go back. I mean, you can imagine, just picture in North Carolina or something where, you know, this great hog farm over 50 years is expanding and expanding and taking over small farms. The idea is, every 50 years, sorry, it goes back to the original landholder. So this great one, and, you know, think what this would mean for Monsanto or something, you know, if we celebrated this, or DuPont. It would be kind of scary. So we'll get more into the particulars on this in a bit, but that's the biblical idea of Jubilee, and it's amazing. I mean, it's in great detail in Leviticus 25. The question that I'd like us to look at today, the ones that we're having, is how can the church and the liturgy help us do Jubilee today? And the second question will be, who are our allies in this celebration of justice and mercy? So first of all, how can the church and the liturgy help us do Jubilee today? In which each, I'm going to propose three little examples of the ways that we can celebrate Jubilee in our churches, and the church can help us do this. And with each one, I'll kind of do some background stuff, and then we'll all together look for some particular ways that that could be enfleshed in our congregations. The first one I want to propose is the offering. Okay. A little background on the offering. Think in the Gospels. Use your great biblical scholarly wisdom. What's the greatest scene of abundance and equality that you can think of in the Gospels? Feeding of the 5,000. The only miracle of Jesus that's in all four Gospels, okay, has a lot of, you know, it's intense. Now, I want to read this, and I want to point out a couple things. This is from Matthew. When it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and the hour is late. Send these crowds away so that they may go into the villages and buy some food for themselves." You know, go to the 7-Eleven. Jesus said to them, "They need not go away. You give them something to eat." And they said, "We have nothing here but 5 loaves and 2 fish. And he said, "Bring them here to me." Then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass. Now listen here. What does this remind you of? Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples. And the disciples gave them to the crowds. And all ate and were filled, and they took up what was left over of the broken pieces, 12 baskets full. Okay, first of all, the little thing about took, blessed, broke, what were you hearing?
Communion,
yeah. And of course, offering comes right before communion with the little offering, 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And how many baskets were left over?
12.
What does that remind you of?
12 tribes of Israel.
12 tribes of Israel, also 12 disciples. One basket each, you know, to go lunch for the people out there. But that's one background, and we'll come back to this a little bit. I mean, that this is, first of all, notice the offering is very small, but when it's offered to Jesus, it becomes this thing that feeds everyone. and there's enough for everybody to be sent out with the extras.
Where did the offering, where did the first loaves and fish come from? Do you know, were they from the people in the crowds there?
It's different in the different books. And the disciples, and some say, we've got it. I think it's in John, they say this little kid has some.
Mm-hmm. He's a boy.
Then Acts 2, Michael's going to be talking about this on Thursday when he does the Bible study, but just real briefly, the first baptism really after Jesus' ascension is this huge event. Peter gives this great big speech, and it's kind of the image of what does it mean after Jesus for people now to be following Jesus, now that he's no longer physically with us. Well, it happens. Thousands are ready to do it. So those who welcomed Peter's message were baptized, and that day about 3,000 persons were added. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. Awe came upon everyone because many wonders and signs were being done by the apostles. Now, here we go. All who believed were together and had all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all as any had need. How about trying that on your next new members class at church? Okay.
Social society.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, so that's just biblical background here. And then just a couple things from history. In a document written about 215 AD, they were instructing what could be brought at the offering besides just money and bread and wine. And they mention, this is from the apostolic tradition, grapes, apples, figs, olives, pears, pomegranates, peaches, cherries, and almonds. Those things could all be wrong. They said no lotus, no onions, no garlic, no pumpkins, and no cucumbers. Sounds, you know, arbitrary.
Okay.
But it's interesting. Those are the things that, like, the Israelites out in the deserts were trying to remember about Egypt. That they wanted to go back and taste those foods, and that they were contrasting that food with manna. That's another note. But anyway, here's this great biblical background of offering. And to get us into the practical questions, let me read this little parable by Herb Brokering, who's been up here as a teacher. Once there was a church where the people took the offering back home with them. First it was collected and brought to the altar. After they asked God to bless it, they took it and put it back in their pockets. They mixed it up with all their other money so that they couldn't tell which was blessed and which was not. And then they left. All week they spent as though each piece was blessed and was to be used lovingly. Okay. All right.
Money can be dirty, though.
Money can be dirty.
Yeah, I mean, it goes from hand to hand. Mm-hmm. And it can be filthy.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could get disease off it. Possibly.
You're saying when it's mixed up, yeah.
It's mixed up.
Well, I want to think a few, just kind of open this up to some practical ideas about how our ritual embodiment of just the simple act of offering in church can bring about some kind of jubilee themes within our congregations. And first of all, I wonder what else besides money could be offered. Some of you may have experienced these things in your churches. Are there other things besides money that come up at the offering?
Services?
What do you think?
Somebody says, I'll clean the church, or someone says, I'll mow the grass, or plant flowers, or...
Mm-hmm. Any ideas how that would look in a service? Bring up your broom or something.
I guess a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. Or writing it on a card and putting it in a plate, mm-hmm. what you mm-hmm. will do for the church that year, or that
yeah,
day, or that
yeah.
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody knows you're actually going to do that. Maybe you can sign it. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. Cook a meal or something?
A meal, yeah. Any churches have baskets of food that you bring up during the offering?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Again, if you think about the offering, often in churches, often it is an actual reality. We're just paying the bills. But if we think about this stuff from the Bible, we think about, one of the things in Jubilee, in Leviticus stuff, God says is, hey, look, this land isn't even yours anyway. You're just here as a tenant. It's all mine. How can we embody that in the offering? You know, can the offering embody that all of this stuff belongs to God?
Well, I guess I'm wondering, in our church, we have food drives every quarter or something like that, where we try to raise 2,000 pounds of food for local food bank. But we don't, and I'm thinking now, maybe we should link that closer to the offering, because it's like a subset, it's a separate activity and not connected with that Sunday's offering, which really it is. It's just that we direct it directly to the food bank.
Okay. So that could even be part of the service.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, all our money belongs to God anyway.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And we handle it with care. We should.
One thing I thought of is clothing. I'm sure a lot of us have thought of that. And, you know, I kind of picture these old ancient churches with their altars overflowing with that pomegranates and, you know, all these beautiful fruits and this vision of richness that's not going to be there for them to eat, but it's going to go out to the poor and the homebound. So we can have, I think, feel a little free to do this. It's been done before, you know.
Do other congregations do, like, quilting for Lutheran World Reason?
Yeah, great.
Then that's always done in a Sunday, and there is a blessing said and an offering of that.
I thought of, like, letters that could be written either to kind of powerful leaders to make decisions about the way we do that. We have a letter offering during the winter at lunch. One of the neat ideas back at my home church that before I came here, the kids thought of this, is that after the week after Christmas, they brought toys that they didn't want anymore, or Christmas presents that they didn't have a whole lot of use for. Obviously, after Christmas, you got a lot of extra toys that you don't need anymore. And then those were offered at the offering and then taken to a community shelter. It was really powerful.
Mm-hmm. We did Amnesty International letters.
Ah, wow. Yeah.
I think that's a real natural one for peace and justice.
Yeah. Somebody else had thought of banners for people maybe in a nursing home that kids could make. To help decorate people's rooms, you know, just remind them that there are others thinking about them. Any other ideas on this one? Well, one Lutheran caveat I would put on this, one of the things that Luther really fumed about was in the medieval times, the offertory procession, which is what we're talking about here, bringing the stuff up to the altar, had gotten huge and just this big parade. And Luther said, you know, look, and he would, you know, kind of go along with the idea of whatever we offer to God, it's really the equivalent of 5 loaves and 2 fish. The point is what God is going to do with what we offer. Whatever it is we're offering, it's pretty humble, and we certainly could be doing a lot more. So let's not, you know, sound the trumpet at how great our offering is, but always do it in this spirit of, these are loaves and fishes, you know. This is not the greatest thing that's ever happened. Our faith is in what God is going to do for us.
The only other thing that comes to my mind is my daughter was doing her internship in Manzini, Swaziland, in Africa. And one of the first most exciting ones she wrote was that she attended a very large gathering of Christian men. And she said, if you could have seen that they danced all the way to the altar to put their coins in the box.
Yeah.
And it was, again, that was the joy that they showed in having the opportunity to return something.
Yeah. This kind of goes back to what John was saying. This is a celebration. This is I think how joyful that is. One of the things that Gail Ramshaw writes in her little thing later on is about just trying to imagine what it would be like to be one of those persons whose land had been squeezed for 50 years, and then to look forward to that year of Jubilee, and that the joy that we get to participate in this redistribution of wealth is great. Thank you. Okay, a couple other things about offering that I just thought of.
Can you think of the hymn that we sing in many Lutheran congregations? What are the words to it? And I'm assuming a lot are Lutheran.
We
I shouldn't
give
be assuming.
But thine own.
What's that? Oh. We give thee but thine own. That's one offering. In the liturgy, in the Lutheran liturgy, there's that, let the vineyards be fruitful, Lord. You know, nice hymn. Another idea would be to use more often justice hymns at that point to talk about, you know, God's justice outpouring and going to the nations, because that's what we're doing. Hymns that celebrate feeding of the poor. The one that we sang last night, The Harvest of Justice, that'd be perfect, because it's all about this gathering things in, feeding the poor, and then even our lives, our bodies becoming offered.
What hymnal was that out of?
It was out of the Gather second edition one.
But Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other one would be Lord, you give the Great Commission.
Yeah, yeah, nice. There's a lot of feed people. You are an offering. Yeah, and I think, it's not. I think it's important to, you know, the bread and the wine are obviously probably the most important things we're offering. But there's a lot more going on there. The bread and the wine are symbols of everything that we offer to God. There's a book, or there's a hymn in With One Voice from South America that talks about that, about how all of our struggles and all of our toils are with this bread and this wine, and we're offering them to God. Finally, the other part, if you want to grab a With One Voice, you could look. It's on, all the stuff is on page 35. In the Lutheran and in other liturgies, kind of the what's often now called the old line tradition, you'll see there's a hymn that says, let the vineyards be fruitful, and it says here, you can sing that one or you can sing another one. And then below that, there are the two offertory prayers. And here's where I think we could really do some interesting stuff to make things really local and grounded. Just imagine what it would mean if we're giving quilts away, or if we're sending them to people, or if we've got, you know, this month we're collecting money, part of our benevolence dollars are going to go to the local food pantry down the street. As we offer these gifts to say, you know, gracious God, you have given us so many great gifts. We now offer this money and these quilts to go to, you know, XYZ Center down the street and to this congregation, a member of our companion synod in Tanzania. If every week our offering could be, or even, you know, once a quarter, we could speak words about where these gifts are going. There's a real sense of this offering is not just about paying the light bill. It's about, you know, a redistribution that has this great Jubilee theme to it, a weekly Jubilee. Yeah. Any thoughts on that? But I think we're designing a new Eucharist for, we're going to use a few times this summer, and I think we'll probably in that include the names of the two offering recipients for the summer, just so the whole congregation can speak, you know, a prayer for these migrant workers and for these people locked in the jails in Georgia, that our offerings are an offering to God for these people. Okay. Let's see. Next thing. Next part of the service. This is kind of a general category. Just in general. And I've really been just fascinated by, especially with the Oklahoma City stuff and that's been in the news so much recently, it's just mercy in general, not a particular part of the service. But mercy, I mean, at the very heart of this Jubilee thing is a sense that every 50 years, we're going to set things right and be merciful. Maybe you made some really dumb mistakes that made you, you know, sell yourself into indentured slavery, or, you know, lose large chunks of your estate. The idea of Jubilee is that you're going to get mercy showered on you, you know, so that this doesn't kind of infect society through the ages. And I was just thinking in terms of how do we highlight this idea that I think in many ways it's becoming more countercultural. I don't know. I was just really struck. I saved a few articles during the trial of Timothy McVeigh.
just great unanimity on the parts of the victims' families who were gunning for the death penalty and used a lot of kind of modern psychological language to say, this will heal me inside. Which, you know, to only, I think there was one Catholic family and one Lutheran family that I read about who were out of the majority and saying, you know, my faith tradition teaches me that that's not healing. That's a way to die. So
getting even.
Yeah. And it was so countercultural. And it was the articles, you know, in a secular newspaper were saying these people were catching so much heat for this idea of having mercy. You know, they were saying, this has been so heinous that we've got to have blood for this. So how do we highlight mercy?
I remember when Ted Bundy was executed. Do you remember that? People were just screaming, and they were happy.
Yeah. Often we'll ridicule the Romans for what they did, you know, with the gladiators and stuff. But yeah, people, we were having barbecues and stuff to celebrate.
Doesn't it have something to do with forgiveness or not?
I don't know if it does.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think so.
It seems like if you aren't going to stay at that vindictive level of an eye for an eye, it has to have, the mercy has to have something to do with forgiving the person for their shortcomings or whatever it is.
Yeah. And I think what the liturgy can do for us is to root us so deeply in mercy. And one of the things that I think about, at least in the Lutheran tradition, is that we've often focused, because we want to focus on mercy, we've often focused maybe to a fault on sin. One of my professors used to tell me about how every time before they had communion, they didn't have kneelers, so they had to turn around in their seats and kneel on their pews, and his father, who was the pastor, would absolve the congregation's behinds, you know, in mass. But for this long period of time, they're on their knees.
Well, that was part of that was too. Our church wasn't rich enough to have kneeling benches,
right?
So that's what we did.
Yeah.
Was we kneeled.
Yeah.
When I was a young child, we kneeled on the floor and used the pew.
And I think certainly mercy implies that there is brokenness. There's sin. There are broken relationships. But I wonder in our worship, in our churches, if we can let mercy be the star instead of the sin. I mean, sin is always going to be there. But how do we let mercy star? And I thought, kind of just going straight back to the beginnings, is it baptisms? We had a baptism here a couple weeks ago, and we like to do them up. And I think when we really do baptisms well, get those kids, you know, if they're kids, get them naked and have lots of water and get them into that water. And then, you know, there are all these ancient traditions of clothing the newly baptized in white robes and surrounding them with people who will physically embrace them. And then even using oil that's scented and beautiful and using a lot of it. That's the way we used to, you know, in Jewish tradition, used to anoint royalty, anoint kings. We do that to everybody who's baptized. And I think of what that means, like the last parish where I was in seminary was this inner city parish in a very poor neighborhood. And what that was like to see everybody come through a baptismal rite with exactly the same, it was like that we were coronating a king or a queen as they came through. And to have just all this beauty bestowed on somebody who may have been an alcoholic without a home, you know, just mercy pouring down on people. And can baptism embody this? That's what we're rooted in. That's the beginning of Christianity. When you birth into the church, it's just being showered with mercy. So,
no, I think an expansion of my definition of mercy.
Yeah.
Because when I think of mercy, I think of, you know, the slave or something that, you know, please give me mercy so you're not, you know, hitting the merchant. You know, you're actually putting someone in power over you, asking, and so to, and I suspect that's a very narrow definition of mercy, and I need help, and when you're talking about mercy, help me expand my definition.
Yeah. What,
Anybody have any ideas on this?
Yeah, well, I have lots of ideas on this one. This will be my plug for 30. One of the things about this, about the whole mercy thing that's interesting, linking it up with Leviticus and then with Luke, who is probably, of all the Gospels, kind of our Jubilee Gospel writer. In Leviticus, where we have the Jubilee and all, and God's giving of the law, one of the refrains that goes through is, "You will be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy."
Yeah.
In Luke's Gospel, on the Sermon on the Plain, when Jesus preaches, he changes that to say, "You will be merciful as your Father in heaven is merciful." So there's this change now in terms of, you know, who do we understand God to be? There's this shift from the holy God to the merciful God, or if you will, to keep those two together, the real way of understanding God's holiness is understanding God's mercy. And what do we mean there by mercy? At least for Luke, the word he uses for mercy is the sense of compassion. So to be merciful is not a sense of pity. You know, so it's not the kind of, you know, like you say, the slave saying, you know, "Don't beat me, don't beat me." I mean, that might be asking for pity, but it's not really. But it's a sense of compassion. And of course, compassion literally is suffering with someone, accompanying someone, being with them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's from the Christian tradition, that's who God is. Christ is the one who is with us, who suffers with, cares with, goes with us. And so anything that would speak of, symbolize, ritualize in our liturgy that way of God being with us would be one way of trying to incarnate mercy.
Yeah, thank you. I think even like as you, baptism being kind of the time when we maybe meet new workers with us in the kingdom of God.
Right.
When you meet a new person for the first time, you can see some people fall into this trap. I'm going to have all these either great expectations of you, or I'm going to be a little bit cautious because you may let me down. But the way of God's mercy would be kind of a full embrace and love of this person, already knowing this is a human being. And but the mercy is, what's the word? There's some Latin theological, is it prevenient grace? It's like there was this great theological dispute, which comes first, the law or the gospel? You know, do you have to be beat up by the law in order then to have the medicine of the gospel, grace, poured on you? And the church, in its wisdom, said, no, grace comes even first, before sin. You know, grace is the one that. Anyway, yeah. I think about the passing of peace, about us really using that as a time to go to people who our relationships are not right with, instead of just kind of folksy time. But really, I mean, I've seen people do this. You know, kind of the heat-seeking missile. I know I'm not all right with you, so I'm going to come to you. Think about what that means for both parties. Really, to sense, oh, I know why this person just came to me. They really want to mend this relationship. Debts are forgiven there. Obviously, confession and forgiveness can be a declaration of jubilee. I mean, you don't have to end with our posteriors in the air. And then communion. I think, you know, we're getting this, that it's a festive meal of God's victory and grace. Sometimes here at Holden, at Easter, we have champagne for the Eucharistic wine, which is a, you know, real celebration. And then even I think we're getting better at this as a church too, but having mercy for liturgical mistakes, you know, if something goes wrong, not feeling like, ooh, we goofed, but just kind of, you know, this is us. This is us at work here, and having a sense of it's all right. Okay. Any other thoughts on how mercy can kind of pervade?
I guess I think of mercy as unconditional love.
Yeah.
Is that part of the concept?
think so, yeah. And that's part of the Jubilee theme is, you know, unconditional. You're going to receive back this stuff. You can
regardless of who you are, what you've done.
Yeah, you can goof up pretty badly over 50 years, but it's coming back. Yeah. Finally, I would put in a little plug for the Epic Dismissal. And I think this is really... This is not a marker. This marker is going to be redeemed. I'm really interested in this and where this can be going over the next few years. There's this theme throughout the Old Testament that when God gives people a commandment, like to the Israelites, God will start with saying, look, I'm the Lord your God. I brought your sorry behinds out of Egypt. Or when you were strangers in Egypt, I took care of you. Therefore, then the commandment comes. But the commandment is always preceded by what God has done for them already. It's because I did this, now I want you to do this. It's a little background on the dismissal. The early church was very conscious of the fact, like with all the pomegranates and all that stuff on the altar, that when they had been fed, what else could they do when they went out and saw the poor? But of course you feed them, so that every Eucharist meant you literally took what was on the table and gave it to others, the widows and the orphans and the poor. I think, you know, today as we become in the United States a less Christian society, or a less, there are less people in the country who would call themselves Christian. This dismissal time, when we move from just having eaten the meal to moving out into the world, I wonder if this part is going to need a little bit more filling out, because I think the door of the church is becoming more significant. What is it, you know, there was some Presbyterian church that had at the end of their bullets, and they said, the liturgy is over, the service begins, you know. There's this sense that we're entering a new territory out there, and how can we say we've had this radical offering, we've had this radical mercy, we've had this radical meal of equality. Now we're moving out into a world that doesn't believe in that most of the time. So I've got a few particular ideas, and I'll be interested to hear if you've got some ideas too. You guys know this book. This is the New Lutheran African American Hymnal and Service Book. And they've included a section called Charges to the People that happens after that prayer at the end of communion, before the benediction, which is like the pastor or some other leader gets up and says, for one example, this is adapted from an ancient one, go out into the world in peace, have courage, hold on to what is good, return no one evil for evil, strengthen the faint-hearted, support the weak, help the suffering, honor all people, love and serve the Lord, rejoicing in the power of the Holy Spirit. And then they have a selection of a number of different ones. But there's this sense that we've enjoyed something amazing here. Now let's go out in this world that doesn't celebrate this stuff, and let's keep doing it there. So just a simple word naming that, I think. One thing that I've seen done is at this point, the dismissal near the end of the service, is to have kind of a, this is a little scary for Lutherans or, you know, for people in the old line tradition, is to have kind of a testimony, you know. I'm going down to the WTO protest, and I need your prayers, and we're going to need your prayers, and this is what I'm going to be doing. The congregation could offer a blessing, laying on of hands of somebody at this point. They're being sent out by the congregation to go embody God's reign in this next week. Let's see. One thing we did in the parish, in this inner city parish where I served, where I was a congregation member, is that it was amazing because it was all these mostly African American churches, and it was culturally very difficult to get everybody to commit to ending our services at exactly the same time. Because the watch is not, you know, often regarded. But it was the most beautiful thing. We all had a dismissal at the same time in this dilapidated neighborhood, And at that moment, then, the dismissal sent us out into the street, and it was like these cascades on the hills here just coming out and then joining together to make this huge river where we all were together with banners and, you know, musical instruments and singing. And we ended up at this large area that the city owned that had let the houses just fall apart. And we were rallying to get them to come fix up this block. And it, I mean, people were looking out windows. What's going on here? And, you know, I don't know that I'll ever hear the dismissal again. We really felt like, wow, we're really in this together. So we could, you know, do parades out the door, even with other churches, too. One thing that's kind of popular in what is often called the church growth movement is called this thing called kindness outreaches. Has anybody heard of this? And I have mixed feelings about it, and I think some of it's good. They go out and they'll buy like 100 cases of Campbell's soup or something, and they'll go out on a busy street corner and just start handing it out to people, just anybody who comes by. And it shocks people, especially in bigger cities. You know, what's going on? Somebody's giving me something free and they don't want anything. They're not advertising. It's a kind of a shocking mercy moment. The criticism that I've heard and that I would sense is like, if they're doing that out in the burbs, how meaningful is that can of soup? You know, it could be a little gimmicky. You know, are those the people who really need sustenance from a Campbell's soup can?
Down they wouldn't have a stored cook.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, but other ideas on dismissal moments, how we might send people out into the world.
I like what you're talking about, because I've always felt, I mean, we say the words at the end of the service, you know, go in peace, love and serve the Lord, and things. And that's it. I mean, it's like we give it a charge, but there's nothing there to demonstrate it. I like the feeling of trying to do something there, just like we've been talking about with offering, to make it feel more than just being
here. Yeah.
Now, what that is, I don't know.
John, I think.
I'm really active with youth leadership in my synod, and I drew a little heat from people when it made this comparison. But I just read an article about neo-Nazi skinhead gatherings and how directly related they were with, you know, if a gathering happened in New Jersey, you know, there'd be more racist violence within the ensuing next 2 to 3 weeks in New York, or along those lines. That the rallies, that these gatherings, you know, send people out, and, you know, immediately after that, they felt this, you know, this vibe and this call. And I brought this up at a meeting where we were discussing what we could do to bring more energy into the youth gatherings. And I made this comparison, you know, well, what if we take a cue from the Nazis and say, you know, really sending people out with the call, and, you know, but to do what we perceive as more positive things, you know, not to have them go curbing people who disagree with, but to go out there and really do good works.
Yeah. They're on to something.
It's a hard comparison to a lot.
I like that idea, though, of what you just read to us from that new hymnal. I mean, I think where the last thing is, you bought the door of the church, is you're really getting that sort of a full charge from the pastor, who is probably the one that would be giving it, but it's like, oh yeah, so it's Sunday noon now. That didn't let me off the hook on that Sunday. I'm being reminded or charged with what we are really supposed to be doing when we do go out that door. I'm very impressed.
Yeah.
Is this the new hymnal with the Missouri Synod, maybe?
I think Missouri participated, but I think kind of the sameness last time.
And what is this other? This other one's Missouri.
This is This Far My Faith. This is just a commentary on the LBW here.
Okay.
But yeah, I think the Missouri Synod is also using that. Yeah. I like those too. It's a potent word to hear.
And also maybe some variety in that rather than every
right, the same one.
Just, you know, go in peace or go away.
Yeah, I think it's just
I wrote and now we're out of here. You know, that maybe there's sometimes it seems to me, and I really love the liturgy and the sameness mm-hmm. of it is part of my worship, but maybe it, in that case it could be more personal. I mean, sometimes in your town that week, you know there's going to be something, or there's like maybe there, and I'm from Anchorage, Alaska, and there may be a native gathering mm-hmm. where they are really concerned, and we know they're going to be meeting that week regarding subsistence or some other, you know, environmental issues or something too. Maybe you could be doing more personalizing those charges.
Excellent.
For what's, you know, where you're going to be during
yeah.
that time, or some issues that are going to come up in your city or town.
Yeah, I think when one person is going to an event like that, somehow we can all participate in that. I just jotted down a list of like if someone is going, maybe the youth are going off to do a Habitat for Humanity work project, can we get them all up there? Maybe have the pastor and assisting minister lay hands, and one of the things we'll do here is have the rest of the congregation hold their hands out in a prayer of blessing. And then they could lead the whole congregation out. Habitat for Humanity, the WTO protest. Maybe somebody's going to go sit in a tree on a land that's, you know, old growth forest that's going to be cut down. Do we dare pray for them and say, go for it. This is the work of God. Somebody who's maybe starting a new job who feels like this is the work that God's calling me to. Can we pray for them? You know, they're going to be sent out for 5 or 6 days a week to do God's work in their new job or any other kind of service project. And of course, you know, the where this all comes from is the sending of the ministers of communion to the homebound, which should, you know, always continue. And that, you know, that can be incorporated also. Some churches will send them a little bit before the final benediction, so you can kind of hear their cars starting. And they're leading the way, leading the charge out as the congregation leads.
Okay, good stuff. Michael.
Yeah, one other thing we need to do at our congregation is okay, as people may leave the congregation and transfer elsewhere, we use there's in the occasional services, a very short service of farewell and Godspeed. We do that at the dismissal. In other words, you know, we're not just saying again, you know, like, so long, goodbye, it's been nice to know you, but simply, you know, we are now sending you out because you will be continuing your ministry elsewhere, you know, in a different congregation, different city, different whatever, and so that's an opportunity too to hold up that family. It's usually doing that, you know, that family as they're going, and so that's part of, you know, the specific dismissal.
Yeah, wonderful.
And, or kids go off to college.
Yes,
like
yeah. We need to pray for them when they go off to college. Flesh pots. Yeah, wonderful. I mean, any kind of life transition, you know, that's good stuff. In these last minutes of this session, I'd like to propose a few things here. This is something I've just been thinking about. Like, theologians have often pointed out that late, you know, in the last 1,000 years, we've often maybe obsessed about, when we think about Christian unity, we think about, do we believe the same things? And many have pointed out, well, perhaps earlier in the church, there was more of a sense of, there's right belief is important, but also right action is how appropriate is that for thinking about unity? And so I just got this idea. I wondered if we can think about maybe relationships to the church. And this is following up on who would be our strategic allies in kind of the Jubilee celebration in the world outside of the what we would consider the church. And I wondered if we could think about secular groups in almost ecumenical terms. When the ELCA went into full communion with the Reformed Church, we talked about our relationship being one of, I can't remember the exact terms, but it was like, there's a lot we agree on, but there's a lot we still don't agree on, and we want to keep up this discussion. And I wonder just what it would be like to think about some groups that the church believes they're doing the right actions, but we're not necessarily sure we agree with everything they believe in, and they're certainly not sure they believe everything we believe in. I just kind of wanted to propose this and just throw this out, see where you all want to go with it. Three kind of lumps of groups that we might be able to consider as ecumenical partners. I'll just put that. The environmental movement, Native people in general, and I had to do a long definition for this one, but groups that are working with the philosophy of from each according to their ability and to each according to their need, which to me sounds a lot like what the book of Acts was talking about with the early Christian church. But and let me just give you the way I saw, I'll give you the Jubilee connections that I see here, and then let's just talk about what it might mean to think of these people ecumenically. The environmental movement, God says, the land is mine, you are tenants on it. And there's this idea, the land needs to rest. And the environmental movement is, I think, the only movement I can think of in the whole world that is still saying that besides the church sometimes, and maybe some Native people. Native people, who else in the world embodies people whose land has been shrunk over time and are hungering for a Jubilee? And then here, from each according to their ability to each according to their need, the phrase I think of is even the recent debate on the estate tax, which I don't know all that much about. But I know what it was designed to do was to keep these massive packages of wealth from being passed down through generations without ever other people having a chance to get in on it. So groups that would lobby governments to equalize society, which, you know, can get pretty quickly lumped into the kind of socialist group, kind of what David Crowe has been doing with Norway. So this is what I was thinking of.
What about mental illness and the groups that advocate on behalf of
thank
mentally
you.
Ill
thank
and
you.
Disabled?
Yeah. And this is the strategy I would think of. In general, what would it work for Christians in general to assume that we're mostly going to stand with these people, just in general, as soon as we hear about a group like this, and then to say we can work out our differences? And these were some practical thoughts I had. Hosting these groups in our churches the way Lutherans might host Presbyterians or Catholics or Latter-day Saints or Hindus. Those groups have various degrees of difference with us, but we would still host them and look for our commonalities. How are we working together? And then work together. Maybe even having some, I don't know what kind of service it would look like, but a work project or even a joint, I don't know.
Well,
if it would
one
be
of the things it reminds me of with the Native people is several, I'm sure it's been done around the country a lot, is services of apology to the Native people.
Yeah.
And I know we've had those where they've been ecumenical services,
mm-hmm.
and they've been very, very well appreciated by both those of us giving them and those receiving.
The only thing that makes me nervous about services of apology is that when the church does it, is that there's an implication that the church is just white folks. You know what I'm saying? Is that the native people aren't part of the church now? I mean, I know that's not what's meant, but sometimes I think that can give the impression that we still consider ourselves a gathering of white people. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be apologized for, and the church is certainly a part of it.
Well, I think part of the thinking is that you got to do that apology to get on to the next piece.
Yeah.
Some of that is sitting back.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think about this? Thinking of these groups ecumenically, almost as fellow workers in the ring.
One of the things we've done in our church, and my husband Paul was one of them that started it, was we have a group which they coined the name for Earth Care, and they adopted a mile of the Mississippi River, and two or three times a year they go out and clean that mile. And then anyone on the committee has offered to go to other churches or synagogues and show them what we've done. And, you know, they're changing from styrofoam cups to bring your own cup and all sorts of things to make people aware. And so all sorts of projects within the church community and then reaching out to other church communities to teach them how to do that.
Yeah. It sounds like they're learning and in conversation with other environmental groups. There's a lot of it. Yeah, nice.
I think, you know, I understand completely and feel comfortable with what you're saying. The reality of going back and doing it in a church with politics, it takes an awful lot of prayer and an awful lot of study and contemplation, I think, to get to the point where you could do that. Because, you know, we have often just a seminar on serving the homeless, and, you know, we've got the political issues are just, whoa.
But anytime you try something new, you're always swimming upstream. I mean, who would ever want to be a prophet in the Bible? You know, life is just tough when you come out with new ideas and people go, oh, but we've never done it that way. Like, so all new stuff is swimming upstream.
And there certainly is, I mean, I think somehow in America, because we believe, and I agree in the separation of church and state, I think somehow that's evolved in our minds to the point where we think that the Bible doesn't take a stand on political things. But I mean, the whole point of Jubilee is definitely, I mean, it's a very political, it's redistributing most of society's wealth. And it is scary. We probably ought to be scared of that because it's been horribly abused. Mm-hmm. But so has its opposite in not redistributing wealth.
Yeah. Historically, what happened with Jubilee? I mean, did it just peter out because it wasn't convenient, because all of a sudden 50 years went by and some ruling class didn't want to give up? What?
Michael may know more about this than me, but the story I've heard is that, and this, I mean, to me, here's the cross right here, and just an indictment of humanity's sinfulness. I think there is no evidence that it was ever done.
Oh.
Right?
That's right. I mean,
so it's a great idea.
It's one of those things that it looks awfully good on paper, but in terms of, because there's no reference throughout the rest of the scriptures or whatever that in terms of, let's say, the nation of Israel as a whole ever practiced Jubilee. Although there is, I mean, and as we look in Luke's gospel and elsewhere, there are, you know, kind of fragments of it alive and you know, various communities or various ways of practicing some of those things happen. But like, did the whole plan of like every 50 years, did they really do this? There's no historical evidence to support that, yeah, they practice it. Like, I mean, you know, like they said, well, you know, God also said, you know, remember the Passover, practice the Passover meal. Obviously, we have evidence that they actually did that, but we don't have anything to indicate that they really did Jubilee.
Of course, the people in power were the ones that had all the made all the decisions were the ones that had all, acquired all the wealth, so why would they want to give it back?
Well,
the poor people who would want it, who don't have any power to say,
why was asking, at what
this?
Point did we fall off the wagon?
Well,
it's kind of the question, you know, when did your banker ever cancel your mortgage?
Yeah.
Well, Michael may well be getting more into this on Thursday, but when Jesus goes home to his synagogue and opens that Bible and reads, a lot of people say he's invoking the Jubilee imagery and saying, this scripture is being fulfilled in your hearing now. And you know what happens to him next.
Yeah.
So to me, my idea is that it happens in Acts. That's the idea, is that we're supposed to be the people who live it out.
Well, but that actually helps me feel that good, because what I was going to say is, you know, at least in this day and age where it's been so long since we had Jubilee, that doing these things at least could make us understand or work towards that. I don't know that we'd ever get to it. But working with environmental groups.
Happens with loaves and fishes. So
yeah.
Should give
that's
us
a good thing.
Just one of the things we, again, at our church of practice, and again, it came through folks in the church itself, started basically with a bunch of senior citizens. It's a thing called collective kitchens. They get together every Wednesday at noon, basically senior citizens, but other people are welcome. And they simply, you know, because of limited, they bring what they have, you know, so somebody brings some rice and somebody brings eggs or whatnot, and they kind of maybe plan a little bit. Well, and whatever is there, they basically together cook a meal in the church. And, you know, it's kind of like a potluck, but instead of bringing all your food ahead of time, I mean, you just kind of bring the ingredients ahead of time. And part of the socialization and fellowship is cooking the meal together, and then, you know, so like, you know, you make a casserole, and then while the casserole is cooking, someone leads a short Bible study, or you know, and then they all just sit down and have a meal, you know, have a good time, do the dishes, go home, that's it. And again, it's obviously economical and everything for folks who are on limited budgets. You don't have to bring a lot.
I mean,
bring the salt.
Well, yes, or this one guy. I mean, every week he brings, I mean, he is no cook whatsoever. And what? So what does he bring every week? He brings a jar of pickles. You can always count on him to bring a jar of pickles. Right?
Yeah. And it's an offering.
But it's an offering, and that's right. I mean, you know, who doesn't like kind of a little condiment? It's nice to have a pickle with your meal. And so, I mean, I think about that in terms of act or the from eat. Well, you know, kind of what's there in your cupboard, you bring it, and, you know, lo and behold, it turns out to be a nice meal.
Nice.